The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your home for serious content amidst an unserious culture. All right, welcome back to The Brian D. O'Leary Show. This is he. I am here today with my friend Jason Purcell. And Jason is a financial practitioner working for an major American non-bank financial institution, and we will put in the show notes a link to his LinkedIn profile so you can find out more about Jason. Welcome, Jason, to the Brian O'Leary Show. Brian D. O'Leary Show, I should say. Not to confuse it with other Brian O'Learys out there.
Yeah, don't forget the D. It's important.
Yeah. So,
great to be here.
Yeah, today we want to talk about the concept of the petrodollar, I believe. And this is with your writing a book, not yet out, probably out sometime in 2024. Essentially, history of money and banking, from what I gather, with a lot of historical notes, and I've read parts of it. And you've been on the Monica Perez, Deep Dives with Monica Perez, talking about a few other, a little more of the older history than we'll get into. We're going to get into, like, specifically the petrodollar era, or you can debunk that as you wish. So
we're going to spend a lot of time in the 70s today. My series with Monica Perez goes back to about 1350, 1400 AD. So it's right. a little bit further.
Yeah. And then, that'll all be in the book probably as you get cranking on that. And I know you're making great progress on it. But let me first get a little bit of background on where you're at and why you embarked on this project.
Sure. Yeah. So as you mentioned, I work for a major non-bank financial institution. I'm in the derivatives market, the bond market, as well as the money market. So one of the particular instruments that has come to, I guess, the surface of the news cycle is the repo market. So I actually handle that every day.
Okay.
Where I work is a very interesting lens into how the global financial system works. So, and I didn't know it was going to be that way when I got there. So it's been really, really cool. When I first got my bachelor's degree in economics, I was thinking that I was going to get some kind of government related post, you know, maybe working for the BLS or something. And, but I ended up in the private sector, thankfully, and started to actually in 2019, I'll just kind of get into my background here.
Sure.
So, whenever you get a bachelor's degree in economics, it's what I call an indoctrination in post-Keynesianism,
okay.
Right? Because in the American university system, virtually all economics programs in the country are really just, you know, it's post-Keynesianism. Keynesianism is they call it the Keynesian Revolution, came around in circa Great Depression era, 1930s. Basically, the idea that government should interfere as little as possible with the economy was replaced with the idea that, well, we have these things called recessions and depressions and financial crises of various sorts. And whenever that happens, it's government's job to deficit spend and increase what Keynes called aggregate demand. John Maynard Keynes.
Bane to both of our existence, I imagine.
Yes, absolutely. And destroyer of nations, as as Tom Woods and Bob Murphy phrased it with their old podcast.
Yeah.
That is the version of economics that most undergrads who have a bachelor's degree in economics, you know, that's what you're getting. Not to say that was an entirely bad experience. You know, I had a lot of really wonderful professors who, really outside of the strict schools of macroeconomics, they had a lot of good things to teach me.
Mm-hmm.
One of them especially I credit with, you know, kind of building my passion for economics. His name was Rodney J. Andrews. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. But so I don't want to sell the experiences all bad.
Yeah.
So, certainly got some good mentorship along the way.
So how did you, I gather you more on the Austrian school of economics?
Yeah, so around 2019, I started to sort of expand my horizons.
Okay.
One thing about the coursework, when you get a degree in that subject, you don't spend a whole lot of time looking at the history of the discipline or the different ways of thinking. Now there is, in a few universities, there is like a history of economic thought. So you can learn about, you know, what's monetarism, what's Keynesianism, what's Austrianism, all these sorts of things. But so 2019, I started to just expand my horizons and I just started reading. So I read directly what Keynes had to say. You know, I actually read the general theory as opposed to the textbook version of what the general theory is and, you know, what's been made of it ever since it was published.
Thanks for doing that for us, by the way.
Yeah, anytime. For sure. Also, I read, I believe it's Henry Hazlitt had a full critique of the general theory. Yeah. That's a good one as well. The big one that really got me interested in money and banking was Murray Rothbard's History of Money and Banking in the United States from the colonial era to World War II. And I've read pieces of the Milton Friedman version of that, because Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz had a version of the monetary history of the U.S. from, I think it's something like 1870 to 1945, something like that.
Let me stop you there real quick. And you know, people come to Austrian economics or in the sphere of Austrian economics from a lot of different ways. I was kind of like you. I took some economics in college, but I'm like, this is lacking somehow. And I don't know how, right? I just don't know how. It's just not really making a ton of sense to me because it was Keynesian. I knew of Keynes. I didn't know his whole deal, right? And so then I just kind of abandoned it. And I picked up a little bit, you know, quite a bit later after I got done with college, starting to read some economics. My grandfather once told me get the Wall Street Journal every day and read it. And so I did. At a certain point, it took me a while, but I eventually did. And I started getting introduced to all these names. And you mentioned Milton Friedman. And I'm like, oh, this guy's awesome. This guy's great. Free to choose, you know? And then I'm like, all right, this is great. Nobody, like, I'd heard of Milton Friedman. He may have passed away recently at that time or, you know, within a few years.
And I think 2006 is when he died.
Yeah, something like that. And so maybe that's why it came to mind. So I'm like, oh, gobbled up Free to Choose and Milton Friedman videos. And then I'm like, oh, no, there's like more stuff. And then I started getting into some of the Mises Institute stuff, probably through the aforementioned Tom Woods and some of his stuff on there. And then I realized that Friedman falls short in a lot of things, but he's a good entry point. And so I was not quite an evangelist for Friedman, but because I think our culture, which I'm very concerned with, especially in this age that we're in, our culture is to the point where that name, Milton Friedman, doesn't even resonate. So how are we going to resonate these names that you mentioned earlier? Henry Hazlitt, Murray Rothbard, Ludwig von Mises, all that stuff. So so that got me basically into the Austrian sphere, which I largely attest to as an economic theory or model or practice or whatever. But anyway, so I just wanted to for folks out there who are interested, like do what Jason did and just read a bunch of stuff, and then it'll lead you to the right things eventually. So continue, my friend.
Just keep expanding your horizons. And I wouldn't call myself I guess quote unquote a textbook Austrian. The one thing that I mean of any of the schools, that's where I align the most closely with. I think The interesting thing about Friedman is that on the issue of money, and this is what the Austrians really completed for me and why I am the most closely aligned with that school, is that on the issue of money, the Austrians put it into the economic picture in a way that makes sense more so than any of the others. So when you look at the neoclassical school or the Keynesians and the textbooks that were written when economics really came to be as a discipline, which is basically in the post-World War II era, they essentially ignore the issue of money entirely. So they focus on aggregate demand, aggregate supply. Everybody in the economy is assumed to have a utility maximizing function for themselves, where they're just pursuing, they're like robots pursuing their self-interest all the time. Samuelson, I think, even said, Samuelson,
the textbook author.
Yeah. Which most of the textbooks to this day, even 70 years later, are still based on his work.
Right.
You know, he said essentially the question of money is almost irrelevant because really the entire world is just engaged in barter with money as a veil through which barter happens. And that is, if you know anything about how the banking system works, that is just absurd. Okay. I mean,
but the Austrians would say that it's human action, and economics also is not necessarily tied to money. It's tied to human action, or that's
yeah,
Mises,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, that would be the root of it. What Mises fleshed out really well in his theory of money and credit is that the amount of money in the economic system and the manner in which it is created will have an effect on the human, on the individual human action throughout the economy and have big ramifications. And that's where you get the thing, you know, that's ultimately where you get Austrian business cycle theory, which is not the only theory of a business cycle that's related to credit, but it's a really useful one.
Sure.
And they're also pretty astute when it comes to talking about, you know, how interest is derived through the preference of people ultimately to consume now versus consume later. Mm-hmm. Everybody prefers to consume now. And so if you're going to convince anybody to set aside some resources, you know, to not consume with their income, the incentive with which they do that, or the reason why they do that, is interest.
Right.
You know, that's ultimately where interest is derived. And I hadn't heard that, you know, in being educated in economics, again, you know, I didn't read that until I cracked open a book and, you know, read it.
Sure.
Right. So that blew my mind.
Yeah. So, dovetailing with that analysis and the Keynesian model, it brings us to like what you're talking about, the post-war economic model, essentially, that that we want to talk about today, which culminates essentially in the early 70s, which became known as the money. Well, we can get into the whole history. You can go to a number of different podcasts, but essentially Nixon takes us off the gold standard, early 70s. And the theory is, from what I understand, is that these agreements that United States diplomats and heads of state and their cronies had with oil producing nations in the Middle East, in particular Saudi Arabia, because that was, I believe, probably the only one that was constituted a nation at the time, really, that had any oil production. It became the dollar. The theory is that the dollar is now, well, Austrians might say
de facto backed by oil.
De facto backed by oil, where the Austrians would typically say it's backed by fiat. It's backed by nothing. It's backed by government saying that's what the dollar is. And then lately I've been hearing that now we're backed by, the dollar is backed by debt. So maybe, since we're talking petrodollar here today, and you have a huge chapter in your book, your upcoming, why don't we dive in to your analysis of the petrodollar theory and why, and if my analysis was even remotely on target, and then what you believe it might entail.
Absolutely. So those are all three very, well, two of them are very similar to each other, and then the third is very different. So my view in everything that I've been able to put together is that ultimately the way that the financial system works now is that the reserve asset, and we'll talk about what that is and why it's important, is that the reserve asset now is in fact a debt obligation.
Okay.
So in my view, it is definitely true that the global financial system is backed by debt, which I think is going to have some ramifications that I'm not sure that I even have the ability to imagine, you know?
Right.
it's been this way for, you know, with no commodity peg or even a nominal one, it's been this way for only 70 years. Before that, we had essentially 5,000 years where all of the circulating medium by which people
pay
each other.
Is this the Bretton after Bretton Woods, essentially?
Yeah. So you can break this up in a couple of eras, right? So up until 1945, really up until the late Great Depression, you have something resembling a gold standard, right? So every country, every major Western industrialized country will convert their currency at least to somebody, maybe not the citizens who live within that country. Sure. You know, after 1933, if you were an American, you went from being able to convert your bank deposit or your bank notes to gold to not being able to.
On par,
right. And that never really came back. Even in 1933, a firm that wanted to buy gold and sell it had to prove that they were in a business that specifically required gold. So they had to be a jeweler or some kind of manufacturer that required gold. Mm. So a citizen, even if the gold price freely floated, a private citizen couldn't go and buy gold on the open market. So it's been a very long time. You know, it's been about 100 years since true redeemability for gold has been available to the vast majority of money users across the globe. But you can break it up into basically you have something like a gold standard up until the late Great Depression. Then you have the World War II era where pretty much everybody goes off the gold standard. And then you have the what's often called the Bretton Woods era. So the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1944 was 44 countries coming together. It's funny, it's 1944 and there's 44 countries who are original signatories, right? Yeah. But they come together at a hotel in, I think the Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. And they come up with this agreement that essentially says we are going to agree to have pegged exchange rates. Mm-hmm. So what we want to avoid is the Great Depression era, where the United States devalues against gold in order to increase its export competitiveness.
And this is Keynes' influence, essentially, right?
Yeah, Keynes was the British. Was the British delegate or one of the British delegates to the Bretton Woods Convention. And Harry Dexter White, who we later found out was a Soviet spy, was the American representative to the Bretton Woods conference. So yeah, very, very convenient. That's kind of an important place to be, huh? For a Soviet spy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Bretton Woods does a couple of things. So you've established the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. You established the International Monetary Fund,
which is the World Bank, right? What we call the World Bank.
Yeah, the World Bank. Yes, yeah. It was what the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development was. Yeah, right. Perfect. You established the IMF, which is supposed to be, and they build up to the idea that the IMF is going to be a central bank to the world. Keynes really, really wants an international reserve currency, and he wants to completely demonetize gold at the Bretton Woods Conference. His view is that there should be an international central bank, and it should issue the Bancor. So the Fed can print dollars, the Bank of England can print pound sterling, but none of them can print gold. Keynes wants to make it so that in the event that everybody in the world just needs more money, because again, we're thinking about a way of looking at the economy where if anybody is in trouble, these people believe that the solution is more money.
And it's not the people, it's the governments, right? It's the governments that we're talking about. It's the people. Mm-hmm. The people get screwed over in all this, but that's maybe for another discussion down the line. But this is for government liquidity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it is this view that And Milton Friedman, even though he was diametrically opposed to the Keynesians, actually is more aligned with the Keynesians on this issue. Mm-hmm. The monetarists believe that in order to avoid a recession, in order to avoid a depression, for the economy to grow, you have to have a consistently increasing money supply, which is That's monetary inflation.
Sure.
It's one of the reasons that they're called monetarists. So on this issue, Milton Friedman lays blame at the feet of the Federal Reserve for the Great Depression, but it's not because they manipulated the money supply to generate the boom in the 1920s. So the Austrian says the Great Depression is the Fed's fault because they engineered a boom with too much money creation, too much liquidity. Mm. Friedman says it's because they allowed the money supply to fall in 1928. That the Great Depression happened, and then they didn't do enough to rejuvenate it, to get the money supply growing again. So on that particular issue, you know, Friedman is actually more closely aligned, would be more closely aligned with the Keynesians. So this is very much the worldview that people are coming from at this Bretton Woods conference. So we need to have a constantly increasing money supply. Keynes didn't want any particular currency to be the world reserve. Mm. At that point, it was pretty well understood that for the previous 80 or 90 years, that role had been taken by the pound sterling. So the Bank of England was effectively the central bank to the world. It also held a great deal of the world's gold up until World War I initially, but World War II, for the most part, cleaned them out. By the Bretton Woods Conference, the United States had about 75% of the world's monetary gold reserves.
Okay.
So whether they engineered it this way or not, and this is an opinion that that I like to quote from a monetary economist called Perry Merling, who's not a libertarian, not an Austrian, but he says, you know, a lot of people have this view that the global monetary system was conceived in the mind of Zeus at a hotel in New Hampshire in 1944, and that's just not really the way it happened. It happened that the U.S. ended up on top, and that it was the preferred reserve asset because we ended up with 75% of the gold in the world.
Yeah.
It was the only currency left that could really sustain a gold standard in any meaningful way.
Got it.
So the idea of Bretton Woods, and it lasted for about 26 years. So 1945 is when the treaty was actually enacted, up until 1970, 71. You've got fixed exchange rates, so the pound is going to be worth this many dollars, and everybody agrees in this 40 block of 44 countries.
And the dollar's pegged to gold at this point too, isn't it?
Dollar's pegged to gold at $35 an ounce.
Right.
And for the most part, all of the other I want to say all of them, I'd have to look into that. It's actually really hard to find the exact original Bretton Woods pegs.
Okay.
Because it wasn't that many years before they were changing them. Certain currencies couldn't sustain that price of, right. They couldn't sustain a certain price of their currency for dollars. But they actually had the option, if you read the Bretton Woods Agreement, which I've gone back to a few times in doing research for the book, you read the Bretton Woods Agreement, it's thought out there that they had to peg to the dollar, and then only the dollar could be pegged to gold. Okay. It's actually not true. So okay. Each and every of these member countries had the option to either peg to the dollar or they could peg to gold. Now, de facto, what ends up happening is another part of the Bretton Woods is the convertibility to gold. So under the verbiage of the Bretton Woods Treaty, it's actually true that each and every country can convert a balance of any of its foreign exchange reserve. So if I'm the Bank of England and I accumulate too many French francs, I can actually go to the Bank of France and say, here's your million French francs. I would like that much worth of gold, please. That's allowed under the act. It's not right. Just the dollar that's convertible to gold. What ends up happening, however, again, there's de jure and there's de facto, what's written in the agreement and then what ends up actually happening. Well, what ends up happening is that all these other central banks across the world for the next 20 some odd years, they're the ones winding up with these huge balances of dollar foreign exchange reserves. So The Bank of England isn't ending up with French francs. It's not ending up with German marks. The Bank of France isn't ending up with, Chinese, whatever their currency was at the time.
Sure.
I don't think it was called the yuan back then. I could be wrong. But these central banks aren't ending up with these huge balances of any currencies except for primarily the dollar. And so it is the dollar's gold supply, that 75% that they've accumulated after the war, that ends up, you know, for lack of a better phrase, coming under attack. And so,
and was there no gold? There was no gold markets or futures markets in gold at this time. Is that accurate?
There was no futures market in gold until
so the price was stagnant.
Yeah. So the only institutions that could buy and sell gold, and this is part of the game of Bretton Woods. They really wanted to keep it this way, because if the only institutions that are allowed to buy and sell gold are the foreign official institutions, so you're talking about central banks and monetary authorities, then it's a lot harder to have speculative betting in the gold market. That's going to, because what does the United States want? They want the price of gold, the London price of gold or whatever, to stay within 1% of $35 an ounce.
Right.
If the price starts to drop below $35 an ounce, then the Fed is going to sell some gold in order, or excuse me, they're going to buy some gold in order to drive up the price of gold. But that's effectively not what happens, right? The price is actually threatening to rise too far above $35 an ounce. And so the Fed needs to suppress that somehow. That would end up, you know, they would end up having to redeem gold for $35 an ounce in order to push the price back down. There's a few different arrangements they come up with over these.
And then you don't have you don't have the gold.
then you don't have the gold, and that's the problem.
Right.
So convertibility starts in 1958, and which, you know, that's quite a big buffer. So you go from treaties signed in 1945, it's enacted. There's a Bretton Woods Act of Congress, because any treaty that is agreed to by the I'm not going to get into that. So there's a Bretton Woods Act in Congress, signed in. It passed in 1945. Convertibility doesn't start until 1958. From 1958 to 1968, all those gold reserves the United States has are cut in half. So you go from about 22 billion, something like that, down to 11 billion. That's what the U.S. is left with after.
And the percentage share of a finite resource is cut in half too.
Right.
So.
And most of it ends up in Western Europe.
Right.
So there's a private conversation that I read recently that will be added to the book a little bit about. But it's between Henry Kissinger and his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, and his advisors in 1974. And it's a conversation about the Western Europeans trying to generate the European monetary union, which would then become the EU, the EU monetary union. So they're creating the foundation of the euro, essentially. So what the Europeans are trying to do is create their own, essentially a European Bretton Woods, where they're going to fix their own exchange rates. In 1974, that's 3 years after the Bretton Woods system has broken down.
Okay.
Right. So the United States has depegged from gold in August of 1971. The United States dollar, which is what everybody else was pegged to, is now floating. So we don't have these fixed exchange rates anymore, right? All of the currencies are floating against each other. In the mid 70s, 1974, this precursor to the European Union with their euro currency, right, has gotten together, and they're trying to set up a new system of fixed exchange rates. And they do not want the reserve asset to be gold, but they want to go back to moving gold and gold claims between the central banks in Western Europe. Now, one of Kissinger's advisors says, we are not going to agree to this because Western Europe now has more gold than we do. So if they then devalue their currencies against gold, then we have to play along with them rather than the other way around. Right. The U.S. can no longer control what the globe's, you know, relationship of its money to gold is. The power is, if they own most of the gold, you know, a slight majority even, the power is in their hands to choose what that peg looks like. So his advice, and Kissinger, despite his evil genius qualities, is not actually completely aware of this on his own. He's asking his advisors questions, and he's asking, they also talk about, you know, they say our predecessors up to this point have been working to demonetize gold from the financial system in general. And Kissinger has to ask, you know, and why is that in our interest again? You know, he's not an economist.
He's not completely brought up on the issue. Yeah, he's a global strategist, in other
words,
political strategist, not an economic mastermind. Yeah,
right. Exactly. Right. So I actually don't remember exactly which question I got there with.
Well, so we may we're at 1974 now. And
that's right.
And yes. what you have is now you've got a
what is the petrodollar idea?
You've got an unpegged dollar or a floating dollar, no longer pegged to any commodity, particularly gold, which most currencies, gold or silver or some other precious metal, had been backed by for, like you said, 5,000 years or something like that. And then there's all sorts of machinations in history to, you know, seniorage and all that stuff. But that's not important what we're talking about here today. So what you had, I believe, is what, 1938, they find oil in Saudi Arabia that is able to be mined from the ground like they do in commercial quantities like they do or we're doing in Texas and Pennsylvania and other places. And so in the 50s, let's kind of yada yada through this, but in the 50s, the U.S. delegation, or the 40s and 50s, they have a series of agreements with the Saudi royal family, and a lot of these U.S. oil companies form a conglomerate, and then they basically are allowed to extract oil from Saudi, giving Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Arabian either government or royal family, literally a royalty on each barrel. Is that the proper analysis of that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's perfect. So it's interesting because, again, we talked about how the world was more or less on a sterling standard up until World War II.
Pound sterling.
Really, it started to migrate away from sterling between the wars. So in the 1920s, the dollar starts to creep up on that mantle. But it's interesting because in the original agreement, I believe the royalty was 4 shillings a barrel. So the royalty is priced in sterling, right? So that's what the Saudis are going to get whenever their oil comes out of the ground. It gets extracted and sold.
And they do nothing. They have the land
for the most part,
and the Americans have all the infrastructure.
Exclusive right.
Or the Americans and British or whoever, Dutch. Yep. You know, they all have the infrastructure, and they're going in and taking this stuff out of the ground.
Yeah, it's almost like a last gasp of colonialism, you know. And I hate colonialism is such a loaded term now, you know, because of what the left has done with it. But looking, colonialism being literally an era where European powers went around the world and colonized places. That's all I mean by it.
Right.
But it's like the last gasp.
Yeah,
of the
character
system.
The character of that is different because you had essentially a sovereign nation after World War One and the Saudis with a royal family at the head of government. So you had to deal with them. You had to, unlike taking over a country and just extracting resources and sending it back to the home country, you actually had to play the game with the Saudis at that point, right?
Yeah. And the king of Saudi Arabia at that point, the first meeting between the king of Saudi Arabia and a United States president is he and Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1944, maybe the same year as Bretton Woods. It's a couple weeks before Roosevelt dies.
Right.
But this is a battle-hardened king. I mean, the king of Saudi Arabia led actual armies against the other tribes of Saudi Arabia in order to conquer this land.
Lawrence of Arabia, right?
Under the movie.
Essentially is what that's the story of, more or less.
Yeah. So this was once a land made up of, I mean, I guess you could say a lot like Texas and the American Southwest probably was when the Native American tribes were roaming it, you know.
Comanches.
But the Saudi family, you know, pacifies this whole region and then creates the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Right.
So it's a whole different, In a lot of ways, it's a whole different thing from what the West is, you know, but they have to deal with this as a nation, and they get in pretty early in the 30s. The British have a lock on Bahrain and a couple of other places, I think maybe in Iran as well. So
yeah,
they got
Iran,
exclusive
Kuwait,
rights in Bahrain,
Iraq,
Kuwait,
all that stuff. Cause it was under the,
after they
got all that land in Palestine, even, you know.
Yeah.
Which we can get
into
another.
In the 1950s, the U.S. actually has to renegotiate this agreement because, you know, originally all they have, they make some loans, Aramco makes some loans to the Saudis for, you know, tens of thousands of pounds, which is not very much to us, but quite a large sum back then.
Right.
But after the war, when everybody else gets wise to the fact that there's a lot of oil under Saudi Arabia, these agreements are actually renegotiated.
Right. And Aramco, Aramco is the conglomerate between a lot of the American and British oil companies.
Yeah. Correct? By then it's got four oil companies, four of the biggest oil companies, Standard Oil of California, what's now Texaco, what's now ExxonMobil, are all a conglomerate in Aramco.
Okay.
Yeah. And they have to pay out a lot more once the rest of the world gets wise to the fact that there's all this oil under Saudi Arabia. They have to pay out a lot more. It's not just, you know, about 70,000 pounds sterling in gold. It's significantly more than that. And I'll get the numbers exactly and post them in the show notes or forward them to you to post in notes. But it's interesting that the price of that guarantee, the price of that exclusivity went up significantly after the war was over. And there were representatives of every Western country you can think of,
right,
you know, going to Saudi Arabia to try and make a deal like that.
Yeah. So we've got a few more minutes here, but I think we'll have you back to have the whole, you know, the story. I may have probably have a series on this because it's fascinating, but you have now the floating dollar, right? No commodity, no metal or anything. You've got all this, I mean, revolutionary with the oil in the Middle East is revolutionary to the economies worldwide. And so the theory is that now the dollar is essentially somehow backed by oil because of all these crony agreements between governments.
Mm-hmm. So there's an idea in every explanation that I've heard of the quote unquote petrodollar system. And I put it in quotes because just given the research that I've done and really, really just interrogating the primary sources. I mean, I've gone through years worth of newspaper archives and stuff to, you know, put this all together. So the idea is, and I've heard it I've heard it explained on Tim Pool a bunch of times. I've heard it explained on Dave Smith's show, which is obviously nothing against either of them. Love me some Dave Smith, you know, but who doesn't, especially in the Liberty community. But the idea is we go off gold in 1971, a couple of years go by, and the Gulf oil states, because they have an affinity for gold or whatever it is, they threaten the United States and say, or actually I've heard it explained that they even started demanding gold and other fiat currencies for their oil rather than dollars. Mm-hmm. So maybe asking for marks in payment for barrels of oil instead of dollars, asking for actual gold, right, for oil instead of dollars. And so then what, again, supposedly happens, the years that I most commonly hear are 1973, 1974, the Nixon administration goes and makes a deal with the Saudi Prince Abdelaziz to exchange essentially what you could call monetary legitimacy for defense. So the deal is the United States is going to use its military power to defend Saudi Arabia in exchange for the Saudis. And this is the crux of it. They're only going to buy and sell oil. Well, they're only going to sell oil. They don't need to buy any, right?
Right.
They're only going to sell their oil for dollars from now until the end of time. As long as this military protectorate agreement is in place, the Saudis will only price and sell oil for US dollars.
Yeah. So the question I have here is perhaps a huge misconception. And I think that there's a narrative been around it, but it's like, so who is buying the oil? I think the perception is that it's the US buys the oil. Does that mean the US government? I think maybe not. I think, isn't it not the oil companies themselves buying oil out of the ground from Saudi Arabia?
So the way that Saudi Aramco, right. So it's really interesting in this way, because the way that Saudi Aramco is structured at that time is in 1971, 25% of ownership of the assets gets turned over to the Saudis.
Okay.
Right. the Americans still own, and this is just a conglomerate of America's biggest oil companies, right? The Americans still own 75% of all of those oil assets.
Which might have been one, which might have been one, maybe two oil companies if they hadn't done the trust busting in the theater.
It would have just been, yeah. It would have just been Standard Oil,
right?
If they had.
Right, right.
I mean, I think Standard Oil would have conquered the world,
right?
If he hadn't done that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I think it would have been good. I think it would have been better for everybody that way, frankly. But without getting into that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, these are American oil companies drilling oil and then shipping it to, you know, they ship it out the, I guess it would be the Suez Canal to, mm-hmm. to the Mediterranean Sea and across the Atlantic Ocean to the United States, to South America. The way that I phrase it is, who's buying oil, right? It's everybody in the world who is short oil. If you're short in finance terms. So if you're short something, that means that you lose when the price of that thing goes up. If you're long something, that means that you win when the price of that thing goes up. Mm. So you got a handful of countries who are long oil. Those are the Gulf oil states in the Middle East and the Soviet Union, right? But they're kind of, relationship with them is mixed because they're the Soviet Union. They're behind the so-called Iron Curtain.
Right.
But there is some energy trading that goes on between the Soviet Union and the rest. So who's buying it? It's everybody who's short oil. It's the United States. It's the Western, the Western industrialized countries in Europe. It's Japan. It's the Chinese. It's South America.
Right.
I mean, it's virtually the long oil countries are a very small group, right?
It's OPEC. Plus now, or it was OAPEC or whatever it might have been.
Right.
And then they added Venezuela, I want to say later on.
So it's no longer Arab. It's just petroleum.
Right.
Right. So Venezuela, Russia, and now the U.S. has the privilege of being a long oil country because we export more than we import. How long that's going to last, you know. Who knows? Yeah. But on net, we're an exporter now. So in the last 10 years, the U.S. has become a long oil country, whereas it used to not be.
Right.
So we're importing about 35% in the mid 70s. We're importing about 35% of our oil in total. Japan was a lot worse off. They were importing, this comes from a Milton Friedman book, actually, but he estimated about 90%. Yeah. Of their petroleum that they needed was imported. The Gulf oil states are receiving massive amounts of dollars in trade of oil because everybody who is short oil needs it. You know, you can't run an economy without it. Can't do it without energy. And the price of it increases significantly with the embargoes of 1973. I think, September, October, 1973.
Right.
And the price had been going up for a few years before that as well. So the energy price wasn't just as a result of the embargo. It actually went from about West Texas Intermediate went from about 290 to 350 from, call it 1970 to 1973. So it's steadily increasing anyway. But yes, the Gulf oil states at this point are flush with dollars.
Okay.
And those dollars are technically in the form of bank deposits at international banks, but that's what's going on in this time.
Well, let's put a bookmark there because I think the story develops quite nicely, or maybe not nicely, but significantly anyway, from there. And then that'll provide us, I mean, I think this provides us a good background on why either you could call the dollar, the petrodollar, or not. I mean, it's provided good background on both of those claims. But I think in the future, one of these next times you're on, we can go through your thorough debunking of that narrative. But we have a lot of history to still cover, and even though that was only in recent memory for a lot of folks, so I appreciate your time here, Jason, and I think this is going to be a fun little exploration into economics and politics and whatever else it might turn into. But anyhow, so
agreed.
Yeah,
if I could just say one last thing for to kind of give the listeners an idea of what's going to come next. So I hope I've done an okay job of sort of steel manning the petrodollar you know, what I might call theory or, yeah, or a concept so far. Obviously, we, you know, you've mentioned that the intent is to debunk, and that is definitely my angle, you know, because my review of the evidence says that it's not the case that the oil trade is what gives the dollar its prominence. But my goal is to give you all of the evidence on either side of that conversation, and so that people can, you know, in the last year and a half, and this is what inspired the book, was we've had a lot of going back and forth on, you know, the usual mediums for political and economic debate, you know, Twitter and, well, mostly Twitter. But the idea is, you know, if the Chinese start to buy oil in Chinese yuan, then the dollar is kaput. Right. And so when you see these scare headlines like the Saudis are dumping the dollar and they're going to sell their oil for yuan, or the Russians and the Indians are making a deal to trade oil for rupees, you know, these headlines are designed to grab your eye, and they're designed to hint at the petrodollar system, the idea of the petrodollar system, and designed to make you think that the dollar itself is in danger of like a hyperinflation or a crash. A lot of times that's the narrative. And unfortunately, it is quite common in the Austrian community to hear, you know, the Austrian economic analysis, whatever you want to call it, the Austrian thought group, I don't know.
Yeah.
It is common to hear things put that way. And so my goal is to give people a really, hopefully a thorough and detailed picture of how all these things came to be, so that you can just, you know, when you see something like that, it's not just an emotional reaction of, oh my God, the dollar's going to
crash.
There's a lot of
moving parts.
Right, exactly.
In an economy. Yeah. It's not just one thing. Like, we didn't have a gold economy.
True. Yes.
Yeah. It was like not.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah. So, all right. So you got a YouTube channel, Purcell Investments. You want people to check that out?
Yep. All right. Yeah. So the most recent video in the YouTube channel is one of me doing some Irish dancing.
Yeah.
But if you want to see some videos of just analyzing the economic data as it comes out, is something that I did, and, you know, something like a year ago. And I've kind of changed my focus to focus on the book, and we'll probably get back into the YouTubing here eventually. But if you want to get an idea of just how I look at things and the kind of data that I look at and the economic indicators, if you're a big, you know, econ geek and want to just look at how I analyze what's going on in the world, that is a perfectly good place to do it. So, and then you can email me at contact@jpurcell.me. You can get on the list by going to jpurcell.me.
Okay.
And I'm also on Instagram as the supply and demand update.
Yeah, we'll have all that stuff in the show notes in case it's hard to remember.
Absolutely.
Here.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I would also like to say that I met Jason through the Tom Woods School of Life. We mentioned Tom earlier. Tom's got a great program called the Tom Woods School of Life, where you learn how to do life better. And I've been immensely impacted by Jason himself and a lot of the people in there. And we learned great things over there. You can just go, you can go find out more. BrianDOLeary.com/TSOL stands for Tom School of Life. And Jason, it's been a pleasure, and I hope to have you back very soon.
Yes, sir.
Chat with you down.
Been a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right. Bye. For more of our podcasts, head on over to BrianDOLeary.com. And while you're over there, sign up for our email list. We'll send you daily emails. You can also find the link for our Substack page and various other resource pages we have. And that's at BrianDOLeary.com.